be grateful for all he had done for them. Changing the seniority system to place them in their freshman year in prestigious committee seats it would previously have taken them years to attain. Giving them in other ways, too, opportunities to play a significant role in achieving governmental objectives of which they could be proud. They were his children. It was his Senate. "I feel sort of like a father to these boys," he had explained to reporters. "A good father uses a gentle but firm rein." He had been enveloped by power. "Good morning, leader. Could I have a minute of your time, leader?" "Mr. Leader, I never thought you could pull that one off." Of course they would be happy to let him keep running it. He thought he was the Senate, Neil McNeil says. Johnson's reasoning was overlooking two factors. One was personal and had to do with those young senators he treated like boys. As had been the case throughout his life, the more power Johnson acquired, the more cavalier he became in its use. Respectful, even obsequious to men whose backing he needed to get power, as soon as he didn't need them anymore, he became overbearing, domineering in his dealings with them. In the Senate, too, that had been the pattern. Not with the most powerful of the old bulls. He didn't rant and rave at the hairy birds of the world, George Smathers would say. Oh, no, he was passive and so submissive and so condescending you couldn't believe it. I've seen him kiss hairy birds' ass until it was disgusting. With these powerful committee chairmen, he was as fawning as he had ever been. But with the younger senators. Another continuing motif of Lyndon Johnson's career, one that had been repeated in every institution in which he had climbed to power, was that the more power he acquired, the more he reveled in its use, flaunting it, using it often just for the sake of using it, bending men to his will just to show them he could, as at college, no student was given one of those desperately needed jobs just because the student needed one or because the student was a friend, no matter how close a friend, of Lyndon Johnson's. You had to ask. And when the power had been solidified, when he was in charge and confident of staying there, the flaunting was as dramatic as the fawning had been. During his early years as leader, he put on a humble pie act that would have done credit to Ella Sinders, George Reedy was to say. This faded overnight. With senators other than the old bulls, he made it clear that no disobedience to his wishes would be tolerated, that his leadership had to be accepted completely, that as he had told Estes Kefauver, a senator who wanted to get ahead in the Senate not only had to be on his team, but had to want to be on that team. Senators who accepted the reign received rewards from his hand, prize committee assignments, prize office space, prize junkets, a place for their bills at the head of the Senate calendar. Those who didn't, he not only ignored, but humiliated, in the hundred ways a leader could humiliate a junior senator. And not all senators, no matter how junior, liked being reined in, liked having to ask for things to which, under Senate rules and traditions, they were entitled, liked having to beg. And those of them who were liberal, and this included not only junior senators but longtime liberal stalwarts like Herbert Lehman, Paul Douglas, and Albert Gore of Tennessee, felt as well that by allying himself on crucial matters with the Southern Bulls, Johnson was the most formidable obstacle to the achievement of liberal objectives. They were already, in Evans and Novak's description, brooding that Johnson would try to run the Senate from the vice president's chair, with Mansfield, the self-effacing, introspective former professor, who was uncomfortable with power, deferring to him. And they felt their misgivings deepen as news leaked out about his plan. Having watched him operate for 8 years, Democratic senators were fearful of what he might do now if he got a toe in the door. An unspoken sentiment among many senators was the fear that if Johnson became de facto chairman of the conference, he would use that position to become de facto majority leader, with tentacles of power into both the steering and policy committees, which he, not Mansfield, would still control. The feelings of these senators didn't matter so long as Johnson still had the old bulls behind him, as the 51-12 vote on Proxmire's resolution had proved. But Johnson was not taking into account that the particular issue at hand, allowing a vice president to preside over the Democratic Senatorial Conference, was one issue on which the old bulls wouldn't be behind him. Strong as was their affection for Johnson, they loved the Senate more, and the heart of the Senate to them was its independence of the executive branch. Johnson must have been aware of their feelings and of their reverence for this Senate tradition, and if he needed to be reminded, both Humphrey and Baker tried to remind him. But having worked himself up, he wasn't listening to anything he didn't want to hear. And then he had no choice but to listen. At 9:45 a.m. on January 3rd, still a senator, he would not resign until the new Senate convened at noon, and still majority leader and caucus chairman, he strode into the Democratic caucus with a broad, confident smile on his face, sat down at the small table that had been placed in the front of the room, gaveled the caucus to order, and said that the first order of business was to elect a new leader. After Mansfield was elected, by acclamation, however, Johnson did not hand him the gavel and surrender his chair. And Mansfield, sitting down instead in a chair next to Johnson's, made a motion, the minutes state, that the vice president-elect preside over future conferences. "Can you imagine that?" Robert Byrd of West Virginia, a Johnson team member but also a very firm believer in senatorial precedence, was to ask. This action reflected the quiet and unassuming nature of Mike Mansfield, but it was a mistake. Another historian writes that until that moment, despite Johnson's signals, few senators had anticipated the extent of his power grab. Now, with understanding suddenly dawning, one by one, liberals, Douglas, Gore, Joseph Clark, rose to stand at their seats right in front of Johnson to denounce the proposal to his face. "I don't know of any right for a vice president to preside or even be here with senators," Gore said. "This caucus is not open to former senators." Johnson's face flushed with anger. While objections from liberals could, of course, be disregarded, other hands were being raised, the hands of old bulls. One after another, Johnson recognized them, expecting them to support Mansfield's motion. One after another, they attacked it. Even Clinton Anderson, one of Johnson's closest allies in the Senate, attacked it, saying that to allow a member of the executive branch to preside over the conference would not only shatter the principle of separation of powers, but would make the Senate look ridiculous. Johnson's face, so red a few minutes before, had turned ashen. "All of the old bulls included praise of Johnson in their remarks," Baker says, "but there was no getting around that they were inviting him out of their inner circle." Insisting that he had no intention of sharing either his responsibility or authority, and that he had intended the motion only as a recognition of Johnson's achievements, Mansfield said the motion was entirely his own idea. He repeated this several times. "With each repetition, fewer members believed that to be true," says a Mansfield aide who was present. Instead, the murmurs of disbelief indicated that they were beginning to suspect that Mansfield had been had by Johnson. When Mansfield made a personal appeal for his proposal, a vote was taken supporting it, but, as Baker says, everyone in the room knew that Johnson had been rebuffed. Hardly had the Democrats left the caucus room when word began circulating through the Senate office building that if necessary there would be another vote, one that would have a different result. When several friendly senators tried to make this clear to Johnson, they found only a reluctance to face reality. "It was too much for him to leave that center of power," Humphrey says. "He was just very reluctant to give up those reins." The senator to whom he had to listen was delegated to make him face it, and after Richard Russell spoke to him, he did. At the next day's Democratic caucus, there was only one chair at the presiding officer's table, and Mansfield was sitting in it. Lyndon Johnson was not present. As always, he had a vivid phrase to describe what had occurred. "I now know the difference between a caucus and a cactus," he told Baker. "In a cactus, all the pricks are on the outside." But no words could hide the pain. "Those bastards sandbagged me," he told Baker. "They had to humiliate me in public." The other front opened by Johnson in his campaign for power as the vice president was a mile and a half west on Pennsylvania Avenue. Previous vice presidents had had their office in the Capitol. No vice president in the country's history had had one in the White House. Johnson asked Kennedy for an office there, and not just any office, but a room right next to the Oval Office. Johnson's predecessors had had staffs of their own, but rather small ones, housed either in the Capitol or in some government office building. Johnson wanted a large staff, a very large one. He had had some 50 persons working for him as Senate Majority Leader, and he seems to have envisioned keeping most of them as Vice President. And he didn't want them set off from Kennedy's staff. He was to ask Kennedy for permission to appoint a staff within the Executive Office of the President, and this would have been quite a staff. He told me, "I want to establish a little Joint Chiefs of Staff in my office," says Colonel Kenneth E. Ballou, a longtime Johnson aide, and at that time executive officer to Secretary of the Army Frank Pace. So confident was Johnson that he would be allowed to establish one, that he told Ballou to begin interviewing senior military officers for the posts. Ballou, taking into account what Johnson wanted in his advisers, had to tell one candidate, an Army colonel otherwise well qualified, that, "You have a habit of telling people when you think they're wrong, and I don't think you'd get along with Lyndon." Actually, Ballou explains with a smile, the first time the colonel disagreed with Lyndon, Lyndon would have crucified him. And then there was the proposed executive order that Johnson, shortly after the disastrous Senate caucus, sent to the White House for President Kennedy's signature. The date and exact wording of the order originally sent to Kennedy's office, and of a letter also drafted by Johnson for Kennedy's signature that accompanied it, are unknown. No copies can be found in either the Lyndon B. Johnson Library or the John F. Kennedy Library. Several persons who saw the order at the time say it would have given the Vice President general supervision over a wide range of national security issues. After discussing the matter with the Harvard historian Richard Neustadt, who was advising Kennedy on the transition, Doris Goodwin was to write that the unusual document, outlining a wide range of issues over which the new vice president would have general supervision, also put all the departments and agencies concerned with national security on notice that Lyndon Johnson was to receive all reports, information, and policy plans that were generally sent to the president himself. The draft of the order and the letter would be revised, perhaps on suggestions from the White House, before Kennedy himself saw them. The revised drafts finally submitted to the president, they have been preserved for history, do not contain the words general supervision. Instead, the draft of the executive order states that, in order to provide a more effective coordination of the department and agencies of the government concerned with national security, the Vice President is hereby designated and empowered to exercise continuing surveillance and review, and to advise the President with respect to the integration of domestic, foreign, and military policies relating to national security. Vague though the surveillance and review phrase may have been, succeeding clauses in this final draft of the executive order made it more specific. One authorized the Vice President to obtain all pertinent information concerning the policies and operations of the State Department, the Defense Department, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Budget Bureau, and the Office of Civil and Defense Mobilization, as well as other government departments involved in national security matters. Another clause said that, in the performance of these functions, the Vice President, whenever necessary and with the approval of the head of the department or agency concerned, was authorized to use their established facilities and personnel. And another clause would make it difficult for a department or agency head to refuse that approval whenever the Vice President asked for it. All elements and agencies of the United States shall cooperate fully with the Vice President in the carrying out of these assignments, it said. The order was not written by, or during its preparation even seen by, the man who had for the past decade been so successfully playing the key role in drafting Johnson documents, George Reedy. Lyndon did not like opposition and was in a mood where he was bypassing me on projects to which he suspected I might be negative. And he was right about this one, Reedy says. When he finally got a glimpse of it, Ballou showed it to him. He knew at once that it was a blunder on his part, far greater than his misreading of the Senate Democrats. No opportunity was given him to offer any input, however. Before I could protest, it was on its way to the White House. A friend, apparently Jim Rowe, to whom Johnson showed it after it had already been sent, was, Evans and Novak wrote, flabbergasted. It was, Rowe said, frankly the most presumptuous document any vice president had ever sent to his president. Of even more significance was Kennedy's handling of the executive order and letter that Johnson was suggesting he sign. When Johnson met with Kennedy in the Oval Office on January 28th, no executive order but only a letter, "Dear Mr. Vice President," was handed back to him, and it contained no authorization for him to conduct continuing surveillance or general supervision of anything. No such phrases remained in the letter, and neither did the phrase, "I am directing you." All the letter said on the subject of national security was, "I am hereby requesting you to review policies relating to the national security," a meaningless phrase that conferred no power at all. There was no provision in Kennedy's letter for any additional staff. There was no mention in the letter of any staff at all. There was no mention of any use by the vice president of the agency's facilities and personnel. All Kennedy was now saying was that he would expect the agencies to cooperate fully with you in providing information. As for the proposed executive order, that had disappeared from the scene entirely. Kennedy did not hand Johnson any version of an order at all, edited or otherwise. No executive order bearing on the vice president and national security was ever issued. Reedy hoped against hope that no word of the incident would leak out, but these hopes were dashed on February 9th, when the nationally syndicated columnist Marquis Childs walked into his office and said, as Reedy later reported to Johnson, that he understood the relations between you and the president were like this, making jabbing motions with his hands like two men fighting, and mentioned that a very responsible White House official had told him that there had been an incident between the two men that was so major that a parallel could not be found in history without going back all the way to Seward's letter to Lincoln. The White House official, Childs said, declined to describe the incident other than in terms of the Seward parallel, but since Seward's letter to Lincoln, actually a memo sent by Secretary of State William H. Seward shortly after Lincoln's inauguration, had sought extraordinary power for himself at the president's expense, it would have made him, an historian wrote, the equivalent of a prime minister with Lincoln the figurehead. Reedy knew that the Kennedy official had been referring to Johnson's proposed executive order. Aside from one rather oblique reference in Childs's column, there were predictions that Johnson would insist that he should be at least equal to the president in executive authority. Knowing persons suggested a parallel between Abraham Lincoln and Seward, and in a few others, the incident received little publicity, a fact that is perhaps the most significant aspect of the incident. Kennedy simply didn't publicize it, and, except to a very few close aides, didn't even disclose it. Lincoln had handled Seward's power grab by all but ignoring it. He wrote a response to Seward. If a policy was to be carried out, he said, "I must do it," but never sent it. It remained buried in his papers until it was discovered decades later. As one of his biographers later wrote, had Mr. Lincoln been an envious or resentful man, he could not have wished for a better occasion to put a rival under his feet, even, perhaps, by dismissing him. But instead he demonstrated an unselfish magnanimity, which was the central marvel of the whole affair. John Fitzgerald Kennedy had handled Johnson's power grab the same way, as Reedy saw. Thanks to Kennedy, he was to say, the whole thing was lost in charitable silence. The president had handled it magnanimously and casually, as if there had been no reason to take it seriously. He handled the same way all Johnson's attempts of those first very early days to expand the vice presidency's formal institutional powers. When Johnson's suggestion that he be given an office next door to the Oval Office was mentioned to him, Kennedy was flabbergasted, his secretary Evelyn Lincoln recalls. "I have never heard of such a thing," he told her. But his response was to simply instruct her to instead give him one over in the Executive Office Building, across from the White House. Johnson's suggestion of his own staff within the president's executive office would be brought up again. Kennedy simply ignored it. When Johnson said there was virtually no provision for staff aside from positions allowed a vice president on the Senate payroll because of his presiding role there, Kennedy allowed him 16 posts that he could fill, attached not to the executive office but to the Department of Defense. At the end of all his scheming and maneuvering, what he got, the only new responsibilities Kennedy gave him, were the chairmanships of two committees, the National Space Council and the President's Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity. The impressive ring to the assignments, the 9-member Space Council had been created as a central coordinating body for America's growing involvement in space, and the CEEO to prevent racial discrimination by companies that received government contracts, was hollow to someone who understood them, and Johnson's understanding was thorough, particularly about the Space Council, since it had been he who, leading the Senate's investigation in 1957 of America's space program, following Russia's launching of Sputnik, the first man-made satellite to orbit the Earth, had introduced the legislation setting it up, and had thereafter watched President Eisenhower rapidly reduce it from a coordinating to a purely advisory body, not one that makes decisions. The limits on the amount of advice Kennedy was willing to receive from the Council became apparent with that body's first task, to recommend an administrator for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Kennedy asked for the recommendation from his science advisor, Jerome B. Wiesner, not from the Space Council or from Johnson himself. Only after Wiesner's recommendations, 9 in all, proved one after another unacceptable, was Johnson's opinion finally solicited. And the man selected on his recommendation, James E. Webb, a former Budget Bureau director who had become an executive in Senator Kerr's oil and gas empire, quickly learned, as he was to put it, that Kennedy wanted to control the agenda of the council, that he wanted to determine those items on which he would accept advice, and, most crucially, that he wanted the all-important budget for space projects to be drawn up not by the council, but by the budget director. Kennedy was not about to abdicate those decisions to anyone, Webb says. The Council's other members included the Secretaries of State and Defense, Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara, and the Atomic Energy Commissioner, Glenn T. Seaborg, all of whom had staffs of technical experts to prepare their positions on issues that came before the Council. Johnson didn't. Attempting to obtain funds to hire some, he requested a doubling of the previous year's $500,000 appropriation for the Council, and the Senate rejected his request, a further rebuff from that body which left him bitter and hurt. The Times would soon be reporting that it was known at NASA that Mr. Johnson's hand, if it has been laid upon that organization at all, has been light indeed. Aside from Webb's appointment, Mr. Johnson's activities and influence there are scarcely visible. If the first chairmanship was frustrating, the second, of the Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity, carried with it a threat of damage to his ambitions. "If you accept the post," Roe wrote him in alarm, "you will become the target of the advanced liberals because you are not doing everything, and also the target of the Southerners every time you try to do something even minor. It will be impossible to satisfy either group no matter what you do." The warning was unnecessary. Johnson was well aware that no proposal had enraged Southerners more than attempts to force employers to hire black men and women for jobs in which they would be working in proximity to white men and women. Richard Russell, outflanked by Franklin Roosevelt in 1941, when, after the Georgia Giant had blocked the creation of a Fair Employment Practices Commission in the Senate, the president had created it by executive order, had been hamstringing its activities ever since, by slashing its appropriations, and by amendments limiting its jurisdiction and activities, complaining to aides that as committee chairman, "I don't have any budget and I don't have any power, I don't have anything." Johnson tried to refuse the job by arguing that it exceeded a vice president's constitutional responsibilities, but found that refusal was not an option. Kennedy, he was to say, replied that, "You've got to do it because Nixon had it before." Since the committee had been chaired by the vice president in the previous administration, his own administration, to show its commitment to civil rights, could do no less than have its vice president take over the job. Johnson asked for an executive order that would assure him that the vice president had authority to chair such a committee, thinking that the order would, incidentally, give him specific powers. Kennedy agreed to the request, and an order was drafted by Robert Kennedy's aide, Nicholas Katzenbach. When Johnson read it, however, he found that it provided only the assurance, not the authority, reorganizing the committee in ways that made Johnson's dilemma worse than before. While the order indeed enlarged the committee's powers, they were to be exercised not by the chairman but by the vice chairman, Secretary of Labor Arthur Goldberg, who shall have general supervision and direction of its work and of the execution and implementation of the policies and purposes of this order. The vice chairman was empowered to appoint an executive vice chairman to run the committee's day-to-day operations, and Goldberg appointed a man from Texas, not one of Johnson's allies in the state, but Jerry R. Holloman, longtime president of the Texas AFL-CIO and a key figure in the liberal, anti-Johnson wing of the state's Democratic Party. Under the way in which the executive order was written, Jerry Holloman has control over the staff, and the best we can do is review his proposals, Reedy told Johnson. Was that not bad enough? Holloman appointed as his second-in-command, committee executive director, John G. Field, an aggressive militant official of the Michigan Fair Employment Practices Commission, FEPC, and the very epitome of an advanced liberal. Johnson tried to keep a measure of control over the committee by having its staff communicate with Holloman through Reedy. Johnson should insist on this, Reedy told him. Administration is in the hands of Goldberg and Holloman. Nevertheless, in the public mind, the responsibility for this committee inevitably falls upon the vice president, and therefore there should be the closest liaison in terms of approving actions. Holloman refused even this suggestion. The next memo from Reedy reported that Jerry Holloman is going to insist that I contact the committee staff only through him. Frantic, Johnson asked Reedy and Abe Fortas to find a way to get out of the chairmanship, only to be told there wasn't one. It is going to be somewhat difficult to drop the committee without some form of achievement first, Reedy wrote him on February 8th. Johnson had insisted on an executive order, and he had gotten one. By the time all these initial maneuvers were over, by the end certainly of the first month of the Kennedy presidency, the misreading of John F. Kennedy by Lyndon Johnson was over too. He had read him now, all the way through. The younger man was a lot smarter than Johnson had thought he was, and a lot tougher, too. He was always, without exception, whatever the provocation, the gentleman, but a very tough gentleman. Nothing could have been more gracious than the way he had handled Johnson's requests, and nothing could have been more unyielding. Some months afterward, Johnson would be talking off the record to Russell Baker of the New York Times, and, Baker was to write years later, there was a tribute from Johnson to the steely strength with which President Kennedy dispatched his enemies. A tribute couched in rather remarkable words. Johnson described Kennedy, when he looks you straight in the eye and puts that knife into you without flinching. The inauguration of John Fitzgerald Kennedy was one of the memorable days of American history, for a presidential inauguration is a day for inspiration. Let the word go forth from this time and place, to friend and foe alike, that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans. Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty. The phrases of Kennedy's inaugural address were so gloriously inspiring, even before the ringing voice said, And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. But they summoned up, and in some ways summed up, the best of the American spirit, igniting hopes so that, almost on the instant it seemed, they summoned up a new era for Americans, an era of ideals, of brightness, of hope. Oh, Jack, his wife said afterwards, her hand stroking his face, Oh, Jack, what a day. It was a very different kind of a day for Lyndon Johnson. The stands erected for the inauguration were in front of the Capitol's long eastern facade. During Johnson's time as a young congressional aide, he had passed along the length of that facade every morning on his way to the House office building from his basement room, with its uncovered steam pipes running across the building in a shabby little hotel near Union Station. The young woman who worked in the same office with him, and who would sometimes see him coming to work, noticed that as he was passing the facade, he almost always broke excitedly into a run, as if the facade's sheer majesty, with its towering white marble columns and its parapets and friezes jammed with heroic figures, all gleamingly, dazzlingly white as they were struck full by the early morning sun, had, perhaps in its symbolic evocation of what he was aiming for, and in its contrast with the shabby little houses of the hill country from which he had come, touched something deep within him. Perhaps Lyndon Johnson had dreamed on some of those mornings of a presidential inauguration day. But he certainly hadn't dreamed of a day like this one. Whatever he had dreamed, it had not been of sitting on the inaugural platform, squinting into the sun, listening to another younger man speak. And as he sat there on this day, he knew that his plans to obtain some measure of independent power of his own, separate from the new president's, had been thwarted. He was going to be completely dependent on whatever that younger man chose to give him, for years to come. Chapter 7. Genuine Warmth. How much of what followed can be laid at that young man's door is obscured by his manners, his graciousness, and his opacity. Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., whose books set the lens through which history has viewed the relationship between Kennedy and Johnson, wrote that Kennedy liked Johnson personally, valued his counsel on questions of legislation and public opinion, and was determined that, as vice president, Johnson should experience the full respect and dignity of the office. He took every care to keep Johnson fully informed. He made sure he was at major meetings and ceremonies, nor would he tolerate from his staff the slightest disparagement of the vice president. He always had a certain fondness for Lyndon Johnson, Schlesinger wrote. He saw his vice president, with perhaps the merest touch of condescension, as an American original, a figure out of Mark Twain, not as a threat, but as a character. Occasionally he called him, in that context, Riverboat. Theodore Sorensen, who did some lens-setting himself in his first two books before a drastic and very honorable readjustment in his final book, and in interview after interview with the author of this book, was in those first two books equally effusive. The president and vice president, to the astonishment of many and somewhat to the surprise of them both, got along famously, he wrote. Their initial wariness gave way to genuine warmth. Johnson's vast energies were enlisted in a wide range of undertakings. The president took pains to have him present at all the major meetings. Certainly, many of Kennedy's instructions to his aides, at least during his administration's early days, support this view. I can't afford to have my vice president, who knows every reporter in Washington, going around saying we're all screwed up, he told his appointments secretary, Ken O'Donnell. So we're going to keep him happy. Telling O'Donnell that that was his assignment, that he was, as O'Donnell puts it, in charge of the care and feeding of Lyndon Johnson, he told him to handle the job with sensitivity. Lyndon Johnson was the number one Democrat in the United States elected by us, Democratic senators, to be our leader. I'm president of the United States. He doesn't even like that. He thinks he's 10 times more important than I am. He happens to be that kind of a fellow. But he thinks you're nothing but a clerk. Just keep that right in your mind. You have never been elected to anything by anybody, and you are dealing with a very insecure, sensitive man with a huge ego. I want you literally to kiss his fanny from one end of Washington to the other. He told O'Donnell that he had given Johnson permission to enter the Oval Office unannounced, through the doors that led out into the Rose Garden, although it appears to be understood that this was a pro forma courtesy. If Johnson never took advantage of it, no one in the White House can remember the occasion. Summoning his chief of protocol, Anger Biddle Duke, the president said, "I want you to take care of the vice president and Mrs. Johnson. I want you to watch over them and see that they're not ignored. Because I'm going to forget. My staff is going to forget. We're all going to forget. We've got too much to do around here, and I want you to remember." Kennedy instructed his legislative assistant, Lee White, that the vice president was to be included in all major meetings, not only of the National Security Council, of which he was, of course, a statutory member, but of the cabinet and the regular Tuesday breakfasts with legislative leaders. And when, at a meeting during the first weeks of his presidency, Kennedy noticed that Johnson was not present because White had forgotten to notify him, he said in an angry tone, "Don't let this ever happen again. You know what my rules are, and we will not conduct meetings without the vice president being present." And there is even a statement supporting that view from Reedy, who, during a conversation with Schlesinger, said, "President Kennedy was rather generous to Vice President Johnson." But that didn't mean that Vice President Johnson appreciated it in the slightest, Reedy added. Johnson was insatiable, Schlesinger said in reporting this conversation. For him, no amount of consideration would have been enough. And that view has been accepted by historians, both by historians who wrote about it first. The president made of Johnson, as much as any president can make of his vice president, a working participant in national affairs, Theodore H. White wrote in 1964, and by those who wrote about it decades later. Kennedy had genuine regard for Johnson as a political operator, and even liked his roguish qualities, Robert Dalek wrote in 1998. More important, he viewed him as someone who, despite the limitations of the vice presidency, could contribute to the national well-being in foreign and domestic affairs, and, by so doing, make Kennedy a more effective president. A number of incidents that occurred during the next 3 years, however, raise the question of whether that setting of the lens was quite as precise as it might have been. Some, at least in the early days of the Kennedy administration, were the result of Johnson's attempts to create an image of himself as one of its key players, a valued advisor. More than an advisor, in a way a partner of this younger, less experienced man, of his attempts to push himself forward into that position, and of the fact that he was dealing with a man who didn't like to be pushed, and who wasn't going to be pushed, certainly not by someone he didn't need anymore. There was, for example, the scene that occurred just before the first weekly 9 a.m. breakfast meeting of the legislative leaders. Rayburn, McCormick, and Majority Whip Carl Albert of the House, Mansfield, Majority Whip Humphrey and Smathers from the Senate, in the Cabinet Room in the West Wing of the White House, just down the hall from the Oval Office, on Tuesday, January 24th. On Monday, Johnson had telephoned Kennedy to suggest that he come to the mansion, the central portion of the White House, in which the President's living quarters are located, about a half hour before the meeting so that he could discuss matters with the President, and that they then walk over to the meeting together, and Kennedy had agreed. Now, emerging from the rear of the mansion just before 9, they walked along the colonnade behind the White House to the West Wing, Johnson, in Evelyn Lincoln's recollection, talking and gesturing, very much the man giving advice. Kennedy let him talk, but he didn't let him walk into the Cabinet Room with him. Just as they reached its door, Mrs. Lincoln saw, Kennedy motioned to Johnson to go in. He himself walked past the door and into the Oval Office. Mr. Kennedy stopped by his desk, glanced at his schedule for the day, had a few words with Kenny O'Donnell, looked at the clock, pushed back the hair from his forehead, seemed to wait a moment, obviously killing time, Mrs. Lincoln was to recall. And then he slowly walked through the door, out through her office, and only then entered the Cabinet Room, where the legislative leaders and Johnson were standing waiting for him. He hadn't wanted to walk into the meeting with Johnson beside him, and when he walked into the meeting, Johnson hadn't been beside him. Then when the meeting ended, Mrs. Lincoln says, Mr. Johnson followed Mr. Kennedy right into the president's office. During the next 15 minutes or so, she came into the office several times with telephone messages for Kennedy. Each time she came in, Johnson, standing in front of Kennedy's desk, was talking, his right arm raised and his forefinger jabbing at Kennedy. In a loud voice, he would preface his remarks with, Now let me tell you, Jack. And each time she came in, Kennedy, saying very little, was shuffling through papers on his desk. Finally, he stood up, looked pointedly at his schedule, and said, That's fine, Lyndon. And Lyndon left. That scene, Johnson lecturing and jabbing, Kennedy fiddling with papers, was one that I was going to see many, many, many times whenever Johnson was in that office alone with Mr. Kennedy, Mrs. Lincoln says. But in fact, there weren't all that many times. During the entire year of 1961, Mrs. Lincoln was to calculate from her diary entries, Johnson spent a total of 10 hours and 19 minutes alone with Kennedy, less than an hour per month. During that year, he had breakfast alone with the president twice. He had had more breakfasts, many more breakfasts alone with the president, President Roosevelt, when he had been a junior congressman 20 years before. And if that incident was a response to Johnson's pushing, there were others that couldn't be laid at the vice president's door. Kennedy's instructions that Johnson be invited to the large formal meetings of the cabinet, the National Security Council, and the legislative leaders were followed, at least for a while. In the Kennedy White House, however, as Theodore Sorensen was to write, it was not in such formal meetings, but in the smaller and more informal meetings of presidential intimates that the final decisions were often made. And to such meetings from the early days of the Kennedy presidency, Kennedy quite often did not invite him. Johnson's exclusion was particularly striking in the area in which he had expected to play his most significant role, guiding the Kennedy administration's program through Congress. Lawrence O'Brien was put in charge of that task, and Kennedy made it clear that O'Brien was, in fact, the man to see. When a senator or a congressman called the president, Kennedy would ask, "Have you talked to Larry O'Brien about this? You should talk to Larry." As O'Brien puts it, it didn't take long for them to recognize that Larry O'Brien spoke for the president. Not long at all. Within a few days, Johnson realized that he wasn't the man whom senators and representatives were calling when they were negotiating about something with the administration or asking it for some favor. There were, of course, some strategic explanations for Johnson's exclusion. One was his reputation, the aura of legislative genius that surrounded him in the eyes of newsmen who had watched his mastery of the Senate. One of the new president's characteristics was an affection for the spotlight and a disinclination to share it. To the suggestion that the renowned poet Robert Frost be given a role in the inauguration, he had responded with approval and caution. The role should not be a speech, he said. "Frost is a master of words. His remarks will detract from my inaugural address if we're not careful. Why not have him read a poem, something that won't put him in competition with me?" Johnson was a master of something, too, legislative tactics, and as one historian writes, Kennedy did not want Johnson managing the administration's legislative program and creating the impression that the president was following the lead of his vice president, a more experienced legislator. Another explanation was Johnson's ego, which, as O'Brien aide Meyer Feldman puts it, Kennedy felt was so great it might handicap the administration. Once Lyndon Johnson was again roaming free on Capitol Hill, his native habitat, there would be no controlling him. If he had been unleashed, he would have found it hard to refrain from running the whole show, his aide Harry McPherson says. Considerations of policy may also have played a role. If Kennedy had allowed Johnson to conduct his congressional relations, he would in effect have made the vice president the judge of what was legislatively feasible and therefore lost control over his own program, Arthur Schlesinger wrote. This was something no sensible president would do. Kennedy therefore relied on his own congressional liaison staff under Lawrence O'Brien, calling in the vice president only on particular occasions. Johnson's exclusion from this area of political activity extended to advice as well as participation, however. "Not once in 2 years," said O'Brien, "so much as stopped by his office to ask for any," he would tell McPherson near the end of 1962. O'Brien, a tough Irish Paul, had great admiration for Johnson, as it happened, and was always tactful and courteous with him, but there was a line he never permitted Johnson to cross. On Sundays, O'Brien and his wife Elva invited senators, representatives, and journalists to mingle with administration insiders at brunch at their house in Georgetown. At one time, during his 12 years in the Senate, in fact, and indeed even before that, during his later years in the House, Lyndon Johnson's house had been the place to be on Sundays if you wanted to know what was really going on Capitol Hill. Not anymore. And on those occasions when, as at one of the Tuesday breakfasts, he offered his opinion on legislative matters, it was not treated with particular respect. He was so resentful at being at the breakfasts with Mansfield and Hubert Humphrey, who was quite voluble, speaking on every issue, says O'Donnell. And they sort of all treated Lyndon like he was one of them, and he didn't want to be treated like he was one of them. If he did say something, they'd say, "I don't think you're right, you haven't been up there lately." These were men who had once shown him deference, and more than deference. Once, after Johnson had given Hubert Humphrey an order on the Senate floor and he hadn't moved fast enough to suit the leader, Johnson, snarling, "Get gone now," had kicked him hard in the shin to speed him on his way. And Humphrey had accepted the kick without complaint, had even pulled up his pant leg the next day to proudly show a reporter the scar. Now Humphrey talked back to him, told him he was wrong. Estelle Harbin, the woman who had worked in the same office with Johnson when he first came to Washington, had observed that even as a new congressional aide, he couldn't stand being just one of a crowd, just could not stand it. Congresswoman Helen Gahagan Douglas, who had come to know him later, and who became his mistress, had noticed the same characteristic. Watching him on the floor of the House when he had been just another representative, she had seen the picture of boredom, slumped in his seat with his eyes half closed. Then suddenly he jumped to his feet, nervous, as if he couldn't bear it another minute. That was the picture of Lyndon Johnson at social as well as political gatherings. At dinner parties, he wanted to monopolize the conversation. If other guests persisted in talking, he would close his eyes and go to sleep, or at least appear to, until a gap in the conversation let him start talking again. And if the senators didn't listen to him, certainly the bright young men of the administration who attended the leaders' breakfasts, O'Donnell, O'Brien, and O'Brien's aides, Feldman and White, didn't. Says an occasional attendee, Wilbur Mills, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, "The president had more or less shelved the vice president, turned him out to pasture. The congressional leaders saw that the administration's men didn't put much stock in his opinions, so why should they? No one listened to him. The greatest legislative prestidigitator of his time had been stripped of any opportunity to use his sleight of hand." In status-conscious Washington, it did not take long for such a dramatic change to be noted. By March 19th, Tom Wicker of the New York Times was writing that "those who have watched his giant strides about Washington this past decade are puzzled. The administration has kept this proud and forceful figure out of sight and out of print." Johnson's response to the new position in which he found himself was to hardly talk at all at cabinet, National Security Council, and legislative leaders' meetings, even when directly invited by the president. Kennedy would ask him for his recommendation on the particular issue at hand, or if a decision was being taken, whether he approved of it. Johnson would answer in monosyllables, and in a voice so soft that sometimes it could not be heard, so that he would have to be asked to repeat himself. One of his tactics throughout his life, one of the techniques he employed to bend people to his will, had been to make them feel sorry for him, to pity him, until, moved at last by his distress and his sad state, they gave way, at which point he would promptly revert to his normal self with a speed and thoroughness so dramatic that they made it obvious that this sad demeanor was indeed only a tactic. This technique had had success even with people as familiar with it as Jim Rowe. Having observed Johnson close up for more than 20 years, Rowe was aware, he says, that Johnson would always use whatever he could to make people feel sorry for him, because that helped him get what he wanted from them. But that awareness didn't help Rowe when, in 1956, the person from whom Johnson wanted something was him. Having observed also how Johnson treated people on his payroll, he had for years been rejecting Johnson's offers to join his staff, and had been determined never to do so. But Johnson's heart attack in 1955 gave him a new weapon, and in January 1956 he deployed it, saying in a low, earnest voice, "I wish you would come down to the Senate and help me." And when Rowe refused, using his law practice as an excuse, "I said, I can't afford it, I'll lose clients," Johnson began telling other members of their circle how cruel it was of Jim to refuse to take a little of the load off a man at death's door. People I knew were coming up to me on the street, and saying, "Why aren't you helping Lyndon Johnson? Don't you know how sick he is? How can you let him down when he needs you? Johnson had spoken to Roe's law partner, Roe found. To my amazement, Corcoran was saying, "You just can't do this to Lyndon Johnson." I said, "What do you mean I can't do it?" He said, "Never mind the clients, we'll hold down the law firm." Johnson had spoken to Roe's wife. One night, Elizabeth turned on me. "Why are you doing this to poor Lyndon?" Then Lyndon Johnson came to Jim Roe's office again, pleading with him, crying real tears as he sat doubled over, his face in his hands. He wept. "I'm going to die. You're an old friend. I thought you were my friend, and you don't care that I'm going to die. It's just selfish of you, typically selfish." Finally, Roe said, "Oh, God damn it, all right." And then, as soon as Lyndon got what he wanted, Roe was forcibly reminded why he had been determined not to join his staff. The moment the words were out of Roe's mouth, Johnson straightened up and his tone changed instantly from one of pleading to one of cold command. "Just remember," he said, "I make the decisions. You don't." Now this technique was used with Jack Kennedy. At meetings, the soft voice was coupled with a face that varied between sullen and sorrowful, the look of a very sad man. And if pressed particularly pointedly by the president for an explanation or a recommendation, he would say, "I'm not competent to advise you on this," sometimes adding that he didn't have enough information on the subject. Statements that Kennedy viewed, in Sorensen's phrase, as being Johnson's own subtle way of complaining to the president about his treatment. With Kennedy, however, the tactic had no success at all. "I cannot stand Johnson's damn long face," the president told his buddy Smathers. "He just comes in, sits at the cabinet meetings with his face all screwed up, never says anything. He looks so sad. You've seen him, George, you know him. He doesn't even open his mouth." Smathers suggested foreign travel. "You ought to send him on a trip so that he can get all of the fanfare and all of the attention, build up his ego again, let him have a great time." And also, although Smathers didn't say it, get him out of Kennedy's hair. "You know, that's a damn good idea," Kennedy replied, and at the beginning of April sent him to Senegal, which was celebrating the first anniversary of its independence. One early incident is difficult indeed to reconcile with statements that Lyndon Johnson was being included at all the major meetings, that he was being made a working participant in national affairs. On Saturday morning, April 15th, he flew to Norfolk on a military air transport service plane to crown his daughter Linda Byrd as Virginia's azalea queen. As it happened, other military planes were in the air that morning. 8 old B-26 bombers were bombing and strafing airfields in Cuba as a prelude to the Bay of Pigs invasion, which would take place in 2 days. Johnson did not know the bombing was taking place or that the invasion was imminent. He may not have known that there was going to be an invasion. Shortly after the inauguration, he had attended a few meetings on the general Cuban situation, but from the moment serious planning began, he was, in Dalek's words, systematically excluded from any part in it. During the month before April 15th, meeting after meeting had been held at the White House and State Department to plan for the attempt to overthrow Cuban dictator Fidel Castro. Johnson had participated in none of them. Kennedy had, in fact, made sure that he wouldn't even be in Washington on the weekend of the invasion. He had asked the vice president to entertain German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer that weekend on his ranch in Texas. Flying there directly from Norfolk, Johnson was waiting at the ranch when the chancellor arrived. On Sunday, with a 1,400-man Cuban exile brigade at sea and heading for Cuba, Johnson was introducing Adenauer at the Gillespie County Fair in Fredericksburg, the German town near his ranch. And on Monday, the day the brigade landed, to be pinned down on the beach and eventually forced to surrender, those of them who survived, to Castro's forces, Johnson was introducing the chancellor before his speech to the Texas legislature in Austin. Only that evening did he return to Washington. The next day, Johnson was invited to attend a meeting on Cuba, a post-mortem on what had gone wrong. Whatever mistakes the president had made in authorizing the invasion, which had left more than 100 members of the brigade dead, with an additional 1,200 taken prisoner, and the strengthening of Fidel Castro's position, it was, the historian Theodore Draper said, one of those rare events in history, a perfect failure, an invasion in which, in an attempt to conceal American involvement, Kennedy refused to send air cover even when the men on the beach, encircled by thousands of Fidel Castro's troops and being strafed by Soviet-made MiG-15 fighters, were asking for the American air support they thought they had been promised. The president accepted the blame for them. Misled though he had been by the CIA and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, those sons of bitches with all the fruit salad who just sat there nodding, saying it would work, about the invasion's chances of success, he took every bit of the blame. "There's an old saying that victory has 100 fathers and defeat is an orphan," he said. "Not this defeat. President Kennedy has stated from the beginning that as president he bears sole responsibility," a White House release declared. "He has stated it on all occasions and he restates it now. The president is strongly opposed to anyone within or without the administration attempting to shift the responsibility." No matter how upset he was by having had to leave men on the beach, Salinger found the president crying in his bedroom the morning after the invasion. When he came downstairs later, he looked a little disheveled, his hair not combed right, the knot of his necktie slightly askew. More than once in the days that followed the Bay of Pigs, friends saw John Kennedy talking to himself. Sometimes he would blurt out in the midst of conversations on other topics, "How could I have been so stupid?" No matter how the realization of the cost of his miscalculations tormented him. Walking into Ken O'Donnell's office one morning, he told him he had had a sleepless night. "I was thinking of those poor guys in prison down there." When he was arranging the ransom of the prisoners the next year, it was, Richard Cardinal Cushing of Boston said, "the first time I ever saw tears in his eyes." No one was taking the blame but him. During the post-mortem meeting on the catastrophe, however, Johnson launched into what has been described as a general criticism of the CIA. Kennedy said, "Lyndon, you've got to remember we're all in this, and that when I accepted responsibility for this operation, I took the entire responsibility on myself. And I think we should have no sort of passing of the buck or backbiting, however justified." At the first meeting on the Bay of Pigs to which Johnson was invited, he had been rebuked by the president in front of the other men at the table. Part of the explanation for the attitude of President Kennedy and some members of the Kennedy administration toward Lyndon Johnson was suspicion and fear of this figure who for so long had loomed so large over their lives, as the leader, as their most feared opponent in the fight for the presidential nomination, of what he might do, this master of politics, if they gave him the slightest opening. All but unmentioned, though the Seward episode may have been in the press, it wasn't forgotten by the men who knew about it, and it proved to them that the vice president would grab power at the slightest opportunity. Newspapermen were still telling Reedy and Busby, as Busby reported to Johnson, that the White House is unhappy over the vice president seizing power. One journalist, Times Sidey, was later to write that at least part of the problem in Johnson's vice presidency was LBJ's personality and lust for power. The more restless he got, the more suspicious of him Kennedy's people became. Part of the explanation was the fact that Johnson, as Kennedy put it, knows every newspaper man in Washington and could, and probably would, leak to journalists any information they let him have. So they made sure he had as little as possible. Another part of the explanation was Johnson's natural aggressiveness, which manifested itself to them in ways that confirmed their feelings that he was still trying to grab a bigger role in the administration than they wanted him to have. That, as Evelyn Lincoln was to write, his immediate thought was of his image, not of the president's. A constant reminder of this was Johnson's unending appeals when the two men were traveling to the same city to be allowed to fly with Kennedy on Air Force One. Appeals that Mrs. Lincoln felt were being made so that he would be photographed getting out of the plane with the president, share in his spotlight. This constant argument, as Lincoln calls it, cropped up every time the two men were going to make a joint appearance. "You don't mean to say that Mr. Johnson is again insisting on riding with me," Kennedy would say. "How many times must I tell him that the president and vice president, as a matter of security, should never ride on the same plane?" The requests were always refused, and the refusal to be allowed to ride on Air Force One bothered the vice president more than anything else, Lincoln says. After he moved into his office in the executive office building, Johnson unveiled a new strategy to demonstrate how close to the president he was, how much an insider in the administration. His car, a long black Cadillac with its impressive license plate, 111, familiar to Washington journalists, would pull onto West Executive Avenue, the narrow street between the White House and the Executive Office Building, and Johnson would get out and walk, not into the EOB, but along the rear of the White House on a concrete sidewalk, past the doors to the Oval Office, until he came to the next door that opened into Evelyn Lincoln's office, and walk inside. After glancing into the Oval Office, which was almost invariably empty, Johnson arrived rather early before the president. He would stand in Mrs. Lincoln's office, chatting with the administration staffers and officials who were coming in and out. After a while, he would leave by the other door in her office, on a route which took him by the press room, where a group of journalists would be sitting, before walking across to the EOB. Mrs. Lincoln felt she understood why Johnson was doing this. "By coming into my office, Johnson was creating the image of working closely with Mr. Kennedy," she was to write, "especially if he was in her office when any of the cabinet men or other officials came in. And by emerging from the president's part of the White House when he walked by the journalists, he would give them the same impression." And she felt she understood why Johnson's car would remain standing outside the West Wing all the time he was inside. An advertisement that he was inside. Part of the explanation for the Kennedy attitude, however, was more personal. If there exists copious documentation of the president's remarks demonstrating genuine warmth toward the vice president, there were nonetheless other remarks. "Kennedy is funny about LBJ," Ben Bradley was to write. "He really likes his roguish qualities, respects him enormously as a political operator, a politician who can get things done, and he thinks Lady Bird is neat. But there are times when LBJ's simple presence seems to bug him. It's not noble to watch, but there it is." Sometimes in the president's descriptions of his vice president, an adjective would slip in that wasn't at all funny. "The president used to say he wasn't like anyone he'd ever known, somewhat monstrous, larger than life, with a comic side." And if Kennedy had given instructions to his aides to avoid the slightest disparagement of the vice president, to let him experience the full respect and dignity of the office, they were not always being followed to the letter. Not long after the denouement of the Seward episode, Johnson dispatched Horace Busby on what amounted to a peacemaking expedition to Ted Sorensen. Busby began by asking Sorensen to spell out what role he thought Johnson should play in the administration. Sorensen, always determined to find les mots justes, paused, and then found mots that could not have been more disparaging. Johnson's role, he said, should be salesman for the president's program. During the conversation that followed, it became clear to Busby, as he reported in a memo to Johnson, that the administration was determined that that role would not include a leading part on Capitol Hill. In and out during the conversation, various assistant secretaries from HEW and Budget would be coming into Sorensen's office, conferring about legislation about to be introduced. When Sorensen introduced Busby to them, perfunctorily in Busby's account, saying only, "Mr. Busby with the Vice President," their reaction was invariably the same, with transparent impact on Sorensen. They would say, two of them separately used virtually identical words, "Oh, gee, I wish we could get the Vice President to work on our bill. That is what would make the difference." And in each case, Sorensen hastened to prevent my direct response. Summing up the conversation in the memo to Johnson, Busby said, "I felt as I left that I had been to a summit conference held on an iceberg between two men who, while members of the same political faith at the moment, each brought and left with his own God." As for Ken O'Donnell, if indeed he had, as he maintains, been put in charge of keeping Johnson happy, he was not fulfilling his responsibility. Feeling that Johnson was a liability who would say or do things that would reflect badly on the administration, he wanted to keep close reins on him. And he did. He informed Johnson's staff that all vice presidential speeches and statements had to be approved in advance by the White House. He couldn't issue a press release without it being cleared, says Ashton Ganella. Imagine if you had been king, and then you had to clear everything you said. Clearance was required in other areas as well. During the new administration's first months, Johnson's Air Force aide, Colonel Howard L. Burris, simply submitted a request to the Air Force each time Johnson was scheduled to travel somewhere. Johnson was often chagrined by the response to the requests, since he was not routinely assigned one of the three Boeing 707s, the same model as Air Force One, in the pool of planes the Air Force maintained for travel by high-level government officials, but was sometimes given, despite his protests, a Lockheed Jetstar, a 10-passenger plane originally designed as an executive jet. The contrast between his plane and Air Force One was further heightened by the fact that instead of having United States of America painted on its fuselage, the lettering on the sides of the Jetstar was United States Air Force, and two prominent insignias on each side of the plane identified it as part of the Air Force's military air transport service. Descending in so small a plane before a welcoming delegation of local dignitaries, Johnson considered an embarrassment. There was a more substantive problem as well. One of the MATS Jetstars were outfitted with the powerful communications equipment that kept Air Force One in continual touch with the White House. And when Johnson asked that one Jetstar be assigned permanently for his use and that the equipment be installed, he was rebuffed. For a while, however, at least no barriers were placed to his requests for a plane to travel in. Then, however, that changed, and he was informed that before his requests could be submitted to the Air Force, they had to be approved by the White House, specifically by Special Assistant to the President Ralph Dungan. You had to ask for and get approval every time Johnson wanted to travel by plane, says Marie Famer, who went to work for Johnson as a secretary in June 1962. How do you think that made him feel? And the plane he was assigned was all too often the detested Jetstar. After many requests, the Air Force agreed to remove the MATS insignia. When he asked that United States of America be painted on its side, Burris had to report to Johnson that Mr. McNamara's office was informed of the request, and the determination was to retain the wording. His LBJ company then leased a larger Grumman Gulfstream, which could carry up to 24 passengers, for his use on trips he made for political purposes, to speak at a Democratic Party Jefferson Jackson Day dinner, for example. But this attempt was curtly rebuffed. A message from the White House was dictated over the phone to Walter Jenkins. The President has reached the following conclusion on travel policy. Both the President and Vice President will use government planes whenever the occasion requires for both official and unofficial trips, including trips for political purposes. Some of the insults were inadvertent. When Kennedy staffers, accustomed to calling him Lyndon, continued to call him that instead of Mr. Vice President, he just couldn't stand that. He felt they were doing that deliberately to humiliate him, Sam Houston Johnson says. One insult, which O'Donnell was to excuse in his memoirs as merely a terrible mistake, involved a 64-year-old lawyer and longtime Johnson ally from Dallas, Sarah T. Hughes. Early in 1961, Johnson asked Robert Kennedy to nominate Mrs. Hughes for a federal district court judgeship, but the reply from the Justice Department, which was trying to get younger judges on the federal bench, was that she was too old. Telling her that she couldn't have the appointment, Johnson had then offered it to another Texas lawyer. In turning her down, however, the Kennedys had been unaware of a salient fact. Ms. Hughes was an ally not only of Lyndon Johnson, but of Sam Rayburn. Rayburn did not contact them on the subject, but after several months, Robert Kennedy realized that a bill important to him, one that he had expected to make its way smoothly through the House Judiciary Committee, was in fact making no progress at all. He asked Rayburn for an explanation, and got it. That bill of yours will pass when Sarah Hughes gets appointed, the speaker said. Bobby explained that she had been ruled too old for the job. Sonny, everybody seems old to you, Rayburn replied. Ms. Hughes's appointment was announced the next day. Rayburn's remark and Hughes's appointment had occurred while Johnson was on an overseas trip for the president. When he returned, O'Donnell says, "You never saw such an outrage. He went through an act which is beyond belief with the President and me. Mr. President, you realize where this leaves me? Sarah Hughes now thinks I'm nothing. The lawyer I offered the job to, he thinks I'm the biggest liar and fool in the state of Texas." The outrage was understandable. In the Evans and Novak summary, the speaker had demonstrated that he possessed enough power to make the Attorney General waive the age requirement, and that Johnson didn't. And, of course, the story of how Sarah Hughes got to be a judge quickly made